My name is Valerie Brown and I live in Bundaberg, and I'll say Terry's for him. Terry is Terry Brown and he lives in Bundaberg too. Today's date is 11th. Is it the 11th or the 10th? Yeah. It's the 11th of November 2011, and we're in Bundaberg and we're recording with the Story Project. We're going to talk about our childhood during World War II in London and the Blitz and evacuation and what it was like to be a child in those days.
Well, it did occur to me that all the old servicemen now of World War II would be very close to 90 or perhaps in their 90s, or have passed away. And so really the only people that can give eyewitness accounts of what it was like was the children of those times, which is us. And so it won't be long into the future, but where the children of the war would be the only people still alive that could relate the facts of.
But of course, I don't know about you, Terry, but as a child, I didn't realise what was going on in the rest of the world. My world during the war was just my surroundings, where I was. We didn't understand much of what was happening in the newspapers and on the radio. No television, of course. And our parents tried to keep it from us as much as possible, tried to protect us. Did you find that too?
No, for me, strangely enough, people find it's hard to believe, the war years were a wonderful childhood because it was so exciting. The fact that I could have been killed at any minute didn't occur to me. Children don't think of that sort of thing. And so after a raid, for example, after an air raid, I would rush out into the street and all the boys did anyway, not the girls, they'd rush and collect shrapnel. Well, shrapnel is pieces of sharp, very, very sharp metal where shells have exploded in the air into 1,000 pieces and they come down.
Why did you collect them?
I don't know, really. There's stupid things to collect, but we did. And we'd all be proud if we had a piece that's bigger than our friends. And, of course, there were prize pieces, like, for example, the fins of incendiary bombs made wonderful toys. And because there were no toys, of course, the toys had stopped manufacturing and
importing. Oh, that's another story,
isn't it? There was no toys. And so we'd make our own toys. And well, perhaps later on I could give a whole little talk about the toys I made in the war out of scraps.
I'd love to hear that.
Yes.
Yeah. But you mentioned an incendiary bomb. You know, that was how we got bombed out in London.
Yeah.
I wasn't there. I was away in the country recovering from diphtheria because I sort of fell into that epidemic that was going on. And while I was away, an incendiary bomb fell right through the roof of our house, right through the attic, right through the bed even, where I would have been sleeping.
Yeah.
And the house was badly damaged. And my father was in the forces. He was up in Scotland in Scapa Flow and protecting the northern part of the country. And my mother was expecting my brother. So she was officially an evacuee, and she went as an expectant mother.
Yeah.
And she went off and left me in the sanitarium, and my sister was being looked after by an aunt until we all came together later on in the evacuation. So we missed a lot of what you're talking about, the bombing.
Yeah. So what sort of life did you leave as evacuee?
Very pleasant, very wonderful. My mother left the nursing home where she had my brother. He was only about a week old. And it was difficult because the country people didn't really know what was going on in the war. They heard the occasional plane going over, depending where they were, of course. But where we were living, where we were evacuated into the country, in Warwickshire, this was, in the middle, no big armament places there to bomb, but the aeroplane still went over. In fact, We were listening to the bombs going over when they bombed Coventry. Do you remember that?
Yes.
I can't remember what date it was. But I know we all had to go down and sit in the hall and play hymns and sing hymns to keep our spirits up, and all the time listening, hearing all these bombers going over and being terribly scared. I was got out of bed to do that, to sit down there. And Mum had to play the piano because Mum was a pianist. And we were in a vicarage. And Mum had walked out of the nursing home where my brother was born and said to the taxi driver, "Oh, just take me away from here, please." She said, "I'm not used to being treated as badly as I am here." So she had my brother in a shawl, a suitcase, got in the taxi, and poor taxi driver said, "Oh," he said, "I don't know, missus, I don't know where to take. Oh, I'll take you to the vicar's wife. She'll look after you." And when Mum turned up at the vicarage and was dumped on her doorstep, the vicar's wife said, she said, "You're a gift from heaven." She said, "All my staff, my girls, have been called up into the ATS and the women's services."
ATS?
Yeah. What was that called? It was ATS, wasn't it?
No, it was the land army, wasn't it? The women used to work on the farms to produce
food. Oh, no,
food.
These were in services. Oh, no, right. These girls had gone to the services. They'd been called up.
Yeah.
And so she said to my mum, "You could be my parlour maid for a start, and I can find lots of jobs for you to do while you have the baby with you, and you can have this accommodation, this room here, the bedroom, and you can have your other children with you." That was me and my sister.
Yes.
When you're ready, and your husband can come and visit you when he's on leave. So for 5 years, we lived in an old genteel vicarage with the vicar and his wife, right next to this little country church, and we just had everything to eat that we wanted because they had their own gardens, their own dairy, and really it was the lap of luxury.
You were telling me once about the jobs that you helped with in the vicarage.
Oh yes, when I was older, because I think I was about four years old when I went there. And every evening at 5 o'clock, the dairyman used to come up from the dairy with a yoke across his shoulders, you know, a wooden yoke with chains on it and buckets of milk.
Yeah.
Mm. And he'd bring them up to the rectory door, up to the back door, put them in there. And it was my job, after the villagers had seen him go, they would come up to the back door and ask for a pint of milk. Or depending on... These were usually people who couldn't afford to buy or had no cows themselves. And I used to have to dole out this milk for them, you know. I used to help a lot. They had bees. They made their own honey. They made their own floor wax and polish. I churned the butter.
The butter... What's do you mean you churned butter?
In a big butter churn, a big wooden butter churn. Somebody had to stand there and just turn the paddle by hand.
Yeah.
Until it got too solid, and then it was put into pats of butter.
Did you make cheese as well?
Not that I recall, no. But down in the cellar underneath, they used to have all this beautiful blue and white china, which held the milk, and the cream used to settle. Then they'd skim the cream off, and it was beautiful cream. This is why I'm still eating butter and you're eating margarine.
Something I'm, you know, for 70 years I've been eating peanut butter on toast every morning. People find it hard to believe, because what happened was there was nothing to spread on bread in London in the war. And when the Americans joined in, a bit later, well, much later, actually. When they joined in, they used to actually fly in refrigerated aeroplanes, fly their own ice cream over, because there was no ice cream in Britain anymore. But they used to introduce a very strange spread that you put onto bread called peanut butter. And I loved that so much, and a lot of people must have loved it so much because it's a very common, of course, spread now in the UK and in Australia and probably other countries.
But at the time, didn't they sell it in those funny little health food shops?
There was no health food shops in the war.
Well, there was no health food. They were called herb shops, weren't they?
There was very little food. There's no health food. No.
But you didn't get your peanut butter in the groceries. You got it in these herbal shops.
And they sold awful stuff as well. Like
your mum used to always buy it from the herb shops.
Condensed orange juice, which was awful. And what else was...
powdered egg in the brown wax cartons.
Oh, yeah, powdered egg. I used to like that. That's another thing the Americans flew over. Because there was no eggs, because there was no chooks, they used to fly this orange coloured powder, and they sold that to the public that was still left in London, which was very few, and used to make eggs out of it, and that was lovely. I used to like that. I was disappointed when we had to go back to ordinary eggs, actually, as a child.
Oh, were you?
No, what else? Well,
we
was
didn't.
There
we
was
hardly
some
saw
awful
any
stuff
eggs.
They used to make me drink for my.
Was that cod liver oil?
Cod liver oil. It was to replace the food. And there was other stuff.
Malt. Was concentrated orange juice. Oh,
and
yes.
Malt. We had to drink all this stuff every night because it was to replace food that was non-existent almost.
And it was all a government issue, wasn't it?
Yes,
do you remember that?
Yes.
Had to give up coupons.
And bread was grey. And the government said, oh, this is... Even as a child, I remember my mother complaining that... The government said, all this grey bread is much better for you than refined white bread, which I suppose was true. But when the war ended and the white bread came back, they said, oh, you don't have to eat that grey bread any rubbish anymore. We've got proper white bread now. And my mother was she was furious the way that they manipulated the, yeah. But, there was lots of very unusual things in the war, wasn't there?
Mm. So, one thing that comes to mind while we were talking, and that is that my uncle, my father's brother, younger brother, was killed in Africa during the war. He was serving out there.
Mm.
I never understood what he was doing in Africa.
Yes.
But he got killed, and he left his wife and three young children. And they were living in a what would be a commission flat. And there was no fallback, no national insurance, no national health, nothing to look after this family. And so they were taken in by my father's other brother because they had room. And they all lived, and many, many families did do this too, but simply because they had no means of support.
Yes. Well... In London, when houses were bombed, which is very common, very few people escaped without any damage to their house, and especially where I lived in what they call the East End of London, which was where all the munitions factories were, the docks or the wharf area where all the ships were, and also in the south of England where all the fighter bases that the Luftwaffe tried to bomb, and... I forget what I was going to say now.
Well, what's coming through my mind now at the moment is the schooling. Because I remember you telling me that the schools closed in London.
Oh, yes.
Because you stayed. You weren't evacuated. Your mother didn't want you to all go, did she?
No.
And
the schools were turned into civil defence posts and areas. And, there was no schools in the East End of London. In fact... I didn't start school until the age of 10, and of course in those years, leaving age was 14, so I actually only had 4 years of education. In those days, as long as you could read and write, they sent you out into the world. And to this day, I'm a very bad speller because we were never taught to spell. It didn't seem important in those days. If you could read and write, you could get a job. We were fortunate, actually, when I left at 14, tradesmen all came up the school trying to persuade us to be plumbers and bricklayers and butchers and...
What, you mean apprentices?
Apprentices. Which people would be astounded in this day and age that that would have happened. Because after the war, there's far more jobs than there were people to do them.
My schooling took place in this little village, and it was a two-classroom village or school. There was one classroom was the infants, and the second classroom was the junior school. And I think that because we being out of London, we were able to study and learn much easier and better. And when we returned to London after 5 years of living in the country, I was the only girl in my class that passed the 11 plus. So there was a vast difference.
Oh, you went to a ladies' college, yeah.
While I was at school in the country, a very funny thing happened. I don't know why, but the headmaster called the roll, and he called the roll for the village kids, and then he called another roll for the evacuees, which were all from London, of course. And so what happened was in the playground, when I went to play with the village kids, they'd say, oh, no, you go and play with the evacuees. And so I'd go over to the London kids and start to play with them, and they'd say, no, you can't play with us. You're not one of us. You're not an evacuee. You've got your mother with you.
Yes.
So there was always that division, I found out. And, of course, being in the rectory with the vicar's wife, who was an ex-drama person, she had all these lovely costumes, and whenever there was a fancy dress parade, all the other kids turned up in bits of crepe paper and newspapers and matchsticks and all that fancy dresses made of that. And Mrs. Mitchison would bring out these wonderful, I remember one year, a red Indian outfit with all these beautiful feathers, right headdress all over and right down my back. And I don't think I was very popular then because of that. But I mean, that was.
But it sounds to me as if there was no war. There was no war on for you. You know, you appeared to have missed it altogether.
It seemed that way, except for that night in Coventry that they bombed Coventry.
Coventry, yes.
And the next day, my mother took me to Coventry because she was looking for one of her friends who had recently moved there. And I saw that firsthand. I saw the cathedral in ruins, in charred.
Yeah.
And smoking,
yeah.
And people wandering around not knowing what had happened, because the Germans had bombed the armament factory there, and all the debris in the houses all blitzed and fallen down, and kids playing in the rubble, in the debris.
When I mentioned about the blitz, I could tell the difference between by the sound of the Luftwaffe planes coming over, whether they were high ankles, Dorniers, or Messerschmitts. I could tell by the engine noises. And also I'd learnt what bomb loads they had and you know, that sort of thing. And it was an awful time, really. And
were you ever caught in an air raid?
Where?
In an air raid.
Caught?
Yes.
Yeah, all the time. One morning there was a lot of noise going on and bombs going off and that. And when I got up the next morning, I was furious because our house had been hit, the roof had been lifted completely off, and I was furious. And I remember telling my mother off and father and my mother off and saying, well, why didn't you wake me up? I wanted to see that. And you know, and I did wake up. The chimney pots came down and through the shed, which made quite a lot of noise and woke me up. But I was used to that sort of noise every night. One thing that did happen was just about 200 metres away, no more, a landmine, what they called a landmine. It was like sea mines, only they're the same as sea mines that blew up shipping. But they were dropped by parachute, and so they were silent. and you couldn't hear them coming down. And they were much bigger, very, very big bombs. And that was, and it actually, I was in what they call a dugout or an Anderson shelter, which is another story. Everyone had to dig a big hole in their garden and put this steel frame over the, or steel sheeting over the top to make an Anderson shelter.
It's corrugated iron, wasn't
it? Yes, corrugated iron. And then you piled all the earth back on top of them.
And grew veggies on the top.
Yes, and, yeah, and... when this bomb landed, it blew me out, it lifted me right out the bunk bed that I was
Did
in
it?
Onto the floor. Yeah, the vibration. And I just, and they always dropped in pairs, and I just climbed back in and was trying to get to sleep, and the other one landed about, oh, that was about 500 metres away, the other side. And, there was lots of tales. Some stories I don't talk about.
Yes, I know. I remember there is one story that that you did talk about was when, must have been one of those landmines perhaps, fell into the garden of one of your school friends.
Yeah, no, that was a bomb. And I heard that bomb come down because the Germans used to put whistles in the fins of the bombs just to terrify the people because... Everyone for miles around thought that the bomb was going to come straight down on them because of this horrific screaming from the fins of the bombs. But I heard that one drop. And then the next day I found out what had happened.
But it wasn't... But before the schools were closed down, it really wasn't unusual, was it, to go to school in the morning and find that there were people not there?
Yeah, I can't talk about that.
I often wonder, I wonder how the young people today would have coped in something like that. Well, they are coping all over the world, outside of Australia. But it's not a pleasant thing to have your childhood interrupted. Is it like that?
No.
Whereas... On a different note, my childhood was in the country. Being evacuated like that was quite enlightening, really, because the people that we stayed with, the vicar and his wife, had no children of their own. And they had two of their... Mrs. Mitchison's sisters lived in Wimbledon, and they came and stayed with them in the country for the duration of the war. And... These people were quite wealthy and educated and informed and artistic and so everything that they had in their rectory was at my disposal. Books, literature. I learned about music. I learned all the wonderful, wonderful china that they had and silver. I used to help polish it. And my education was sort of refined and completed there, whereas for people who, the children who stayed in London, it would have been a totally different experience, totally.
One bright note I could talk about, one of the brighter notes of the war, that propaganda, we might think we've got a good deal of propaganda now, but it was nothing compared with in the war. The minds of the people had to be switched and concentrated on the enemy. And the description of the enemy that children received was what you, if you was trying to describe someone coming from outer space, they weren't one of us, they weren't real people, you know, they were awful people and they weren't human like we were, you know. And this was how the Germans were portrayed. But at the end of the war, when Britain started collecting German prisoners, there was no need to build prison camps in because they couldn't escape, because, of course, the British Isles are islands, and so they couldn't escape. So they used to just wander around loose. And in fact, they used to work as farm labourers on the farms, and they weren't locked up or anything like that. And some friends of mine said, "Oh, come, some German prisoners of war has just arrived." And I thought, they're just up in the forest there, and they're surrounded by barbed wire. And come, let's go and have a look and see what they look like. Well, when I got up there, the first thing I noticed was that they looked exactly the same as my dad or my uncle. You know, I thought, well, they look quite ordinary, you know. Mm-hmm. And this was how I was brainwashed. And then they started throwing lollies over the wire at us and shouting at us and calling us and waving.
Lollies?
And when sweets as we called them. And when I picked up these sweets, I can remember what they were. They were chocolate caramels. To, you know, after 70 years, I can remember what that, because I hadn't seen, or London children hadn't seen sweets or lollies of any description, or fruit, or lots of and chocolates, lots of luxuries. We hadn't seen it for 5 years. And it suddenly occurred to me, I thought, well, even as a child, I thought, isn't that typically British? They won't give the children sweets for 5 years, but they give them to the German prisoners. And they were thrown, yeah, they'd been issued with chocolate caramels. Anyway, we thought, oh, we're on a good thing here. And I was quite small. I would have been 12 in 1945. And so the bigger kids with us, about 14, they broke a branch off a tree, pushed it underneath the barbed wire and said, someone can crawl under there. And as they looked around, I could see them all staring at me because I was the smallest child. And so I crawled under the barbed wire, and all these Germans made such a fuss at me. It suddenly occurred to me that I'd been brainwashed, you know. I thought, that, no, they're just ordinary people. They're just like my dad and my uncle and our neighbours. And so, that was quite a surprise to me.
So you actually broke into a prisoner of war camp?
Yeah, well, after the war, I kept reading all these books about people breaking out of prisoners of war, and I thought, I'm probably the only person in the world that's ever broken into one. Yeah.
But they had German prisoners of war and Italian prisoners of war.
Well, I always thought, well, this is a good thing, there's an Italian camp down the road, and we'll go and, the prisoners of war, we'll go and visit them. And there was a big lake nearby, and they collected all the reeds, or bulrushes as we called them, and they were making baskets. And they were so expert at weaving these baskets. Obviously, they'd been doing that all their life. And it's probably from country areas from Italy. And they made a fuss of us too, because there was a branch overhanging their fence. There was no wires, just a fence. And so we all crawled along this branch and dropped down inside the fence, and we got talking to the Italian prisoners of war. So that was after, you know, just at the end, the war was coming to a close.
Yeah, but sweet rationing wasn't. That went on and on, didn't it, sweet rationing?
1952.
Oh, my goodness.
From 1939 to 1952, there was no lollies, chocolate, sweets in there, no.
Talking about sweets and things like that, you mentioned fruit, and I remember my mother buying an orange.
Yeah.
You'd buy them by the one.
One,
not by the kilo.
No, one orange.
And one orange used to get cut up into as many slices as you could make of it and handed around on a plate.
Yes.
It's hard to believe now, isn't
it? Well, I'd never seen... Well, I was six when the war broke out. I don't ever remember seeing, well, I was about 13 or 14 when fruit was first imported. And I don't ever remember seeing a grapefruit or a pineapple especially. And I knew what bananas looked like, but I'd never seen one. Yeah, and it was, I was about... Well, 13 years old before I'd ever seen all these.
Because,
things.
Of course, all these fruits had to come from overseas.
They were imported.
And
there was no imports at all. No. For 7 years, there was no imports.
Yeah.
No, Britain had to grow everything themselves, which they did.
Yeah.
Parks were all dug up and turned into what we now know as allotments. There was no grass anywhere. we didn't have nature strips in the East End of London. You stepped straight out your front room onto the pavement. There was no gardens, all the public gardens were dug up. If there was any grass anywhere, you dug it up and planted veggies.
Yes, even in the gardens. I know we were encouraged to keep chooks and rabbits.
Oh, when we went back
to London, yeah. Of course, the shortages were still going and they went on and on and on, didn't they?
They didn't lay many eggs because there was no chook food. You just had to give them scraps, and there was no scraps, really. Mm. Potato peelings.
Mm. Yeah. You mentioned the toys that you made.
Oh, yeah.
My cousin used to make marbles from clay.
Yeah, yes, we did.
What else did you use?
Well, there was no marbles, so you got dug up clay, rolled them into a ball in your hand, and Mum used to bake them in the oven.
Oh.
The war dominated our life as children, and so we used to make guns. And we used to dress up and make out their uniforms, and used to make guns out of scrap. For example, the conduit that electricians used to put the wiring in, we'd get them out of bombed houses. Because we used to get all our scrap and materials from houses that had been bombed and were decimated, couldn't live in them again. And after the war, those all cleared out. But you could get unlimited supplies of different shaped wood and electrical wiring and cord and rope and sheets of iron, and we used to dig a big hole on a bomb, what they call bomb debris, where there's just a big open space where there was nothing left, it was just obliterated. And we'd dig a big hole in the ground, cover it up with iron that got from scrap from factories that were bombed or houses, cover the hole up, and that became a den, what we called a den. Mm. And we'd all sit under there, sit under this iron, making out that we were on the battlefront with our homemade machine guns and rifles that we'd made, and they were quite elaborate, made out of scrap. Mm,
mm.
Today they'd be illegal because they look too much like real weapons.
Mm. But it would have been very dangerous, wouldn't it, to have gone into those houses?
It was dangerous, and lots of children.
What did you feel like
children occasionally were killed when it fell down on them. Yeah.
What did you feel like when you first went into one?
Well, we didn't think as adults. Everything was good fun. You know, our whole concentration was having fun. And there was things that stuck into my... For example, I went into a house that wasn't... It couldn't have been lived in, and the people had left in such a hurry. I opened a cupboard door, and there were all toys in the cupboard. And in those days, we were brought up to think, which might seem strange now, but I slammed the door shut quick because I thought, I shouldn't be in here. I shouldn't be looking at these. You know.
But the house was bombed.
No one lived there, but they belonged to some children. They weren't my toys, so... In those days, you didn't touch anything that wasn't yours, and I shut the door quick, and I felt sort of ashamed for opening the door and seeing all these toys.
Then you had none of your own?
Oh, no. But the way children think was, it never occurred to me, you know, what happened to this child.
No.
Yeah.
Sad times. But what do you think...
All coming back to me.
I often think these days that to look back on those days, it was... There had to be some good come from it. What did you think... What would you have thought was good from those days?
Oh, well, immediately I think of neighbours. The neighbours wasn't just someone that lived next door or across the road. They all suddenly became such close friends... that they were like relatives, because you had to all rely on each other. People forever running out of things, candles, if you ran out of candles, you'd go across the road and knock on the neighbour's door, have you got any candles to spare? And they'd say, oh yes, but I need a cup of sugar.
Mm.
And sugar was in very strict rationing. I mean, people in the future could actually look on the internet and look back and find out what the rationing was in the war, and they'd be absolutely horrified, because people now and in the future would use a week's rationing every day of their life in normal life. Yeah.
I often think about the changes that it's made to me, just being through those years, and seeing, you know, a lot of my family killed or lost, and although my everyday living was not really a hardship, I still get angry when I feel that somebody's doing something that's not right, and they're getting away with it. It's brought out a very, very strong sense of justice and fairness that I miss in life today. What do you think it's done for you?
Well, I'll give you an example how things have changed. Our youngest son, Vincent, was 14, and he was on school holidays, and he wanted to come out on a job with me, and I was doing maintenance work and repairing houses for people, and I went along to this very old house, in Australia, and it was a big mansion, in fact, and the lady there said that it was used as a hospital in the war for American troops.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, by the side of the front door was a big piece of plywood, and I pulled off this plywood, and there was some very ornate turnings behind it. And my son suddenly said, "What used to be over there before you took the plywood?" I said, "Oh, nothing." He said, "But it's all open." I said, "Yeah, well, that's how it was. That's how it was built." He said, "But I could crawl through there." I said, "Yeah, you can now, but when this house was built, burglary was a profession, and only professional burglars only went to very rich people's areas, and it was a very, very tiny minority of the public." I said, "You didn't break into people's houses. It wasn't done." And he couldn't. I stand and trying to convince, and I couldn't convince him that that was built. That house was built, and until perhaps the 1950s or somewhere like that, it was left open. And that, in fact, there was no need to crawl through the hole, because the front door would be open or unlocked. No one locked their doors.
Yeah.
And so if someone did want to come in, there's no need to crawl through holes. You just open the front door and walked in. And I remember talking about our childhood. Do you remember the keys?
I know what you're going to say.
If Mum went out, she'd hang a key. There was always permanently a key, the latch
door
key to the door key, was hung on a piece of string.
Yeah.
Now, in England, the letterboxes were in all front doors. The postman had to put go out to the front door and push them through a letterbox. And if you put your hand through the letterbox, you could grab hold of the string, pull the string, and the door came, and you opened the door. Well, everyone knew that. So they might just have left it in the door anyway, because everyone knew they were there, and we'd let ourselves in. Yeah.
Did you ever get burgled?
No, nor did we. Never heard of such a thing.
Nor did we.
I never heard of any crime. In the East End of London, it's supposed to be a rough area, but there was no crime.
Actually,
it's just something that can't be explained now.
Well, it's just a spirit for survival. I think everybody was so intent on surviving that, and also helping others to survive too.
Yes. Oh yeah. Well, I can't think of much else to do with the war years. I've got lots of things I could say. I actually had to write them down, didn't I? I wrote my memoirs. And all these things that I can't talk about now, I wrote down.
Thank goodness you did.
After 70 years, I still can't.
It's not easy to forget.
No.